For those of you that remain, you can take your Bibles in hand and turn to Matthew chapter 2 today. Matthew chapter 2. We're going to look at the first 12 verses of this chapter together. It is a traditional Christmas story. And so very familiar, I'm sure, to many of you. As a matter of fact, these characters show up even on lawns for people. Well, figurines of these characters, not the actual characters, but the figurines show up on lawns even of people who really don't know much about Christianity and Jesus coming to this earth, but they get caught up in the Christmas spirit, and so they put wise men out on their front yard this time of year. And today we're going to look a little bit at their story, the story of the three wise men. I've entitled this morning's message, The Attentive Ones, because I think it's very obvious as we read through the text together, you're going to see here that these were very attentive. The Magi, or the wise men as they've been traditionally called, are students of the skies, and they were watching to the extent that when they saw the star, they understood what it meant, and they went to find the King of the Jews. They were very attentive. They were paying attention. And there's something of a challenge there for us too this morning to be attentive as well, to be paying attention in our own lives. I know that this is a particular challenge for me, and in 2019 I've begun praying that God would make me more attentive with what's going on in the church, what's going on in my life, in my family's life. Obviously, we're still in very much in transition, but I want to pay attention to what God is doing so that I can be swift to obey when He leads. I want to be sensitive to the Holy Spirit's working in my life and all of that. So I've learned some lessons watching the example of the three wise men. Hopefully, you are in Matthew chapter 2 by now. I'm going to read verses 1 through 12. This is basically just going to set up the context for you this morning so that you know what we're dealing with in the passage, what it says. And then we're going to take some time and work through there. I'm going to explain some of these thoughts and verses as we go down through systematically 1 through 12. And that way, hopefully by the end of the morning, it's a little bit clearer and everybody recognizes what's going on in the passage a little bit more fully. It says this in Matthew 2, 1 through 12. Now, when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, there came wise men from the east to Jerusalem, saying, Where is he that is born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and are come to worship him. When Herod the king had heard that these things, he was troubled in all Jerusalem with him. And when he had gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he demanded of them where Christ should be born. And they said unto him, In Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written by the prophet, For thou, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, art not the least among the princes of Judah, for out of thee shall come a governor that shall rule my people Israel. Then Herod, when he had privately called the wise men, inquired of them diligently what time the star appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, Go and search diligently for the young child. And when you have found him, bring me word again, that I may come and worship him also. And when they had heard the king, they departed. And lo, the star which they saw in the east went before them until it came and stood over where the young child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceeding great joy. And when they were come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary his mother, and fell down and worshipped him. And when they had opened their treasures, they presented unto him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned of God in a dream that they should not return to Herod, they departed into their own country another way. We'll stop there for this morning. I've got 3 points to be made. First of all, in verses 1 and 2, we see the arrival of the Magi in Jerusalem. Verses 3 through 8, while the Magi were in Jerusalem. And then verses 9 through 12, the departure of the Magi from Jerusalem. So I broke this into three what seems obvious real categories to the story. As the Magi arrive in Jerusalem, while they're in Jerusalem, and then their departure from Jerusalem as they go down to Bethlehem, which wasn't far, and find Jesus there with Mary, his mother, and they present their gifts. So let's look at these three time periods, you might say. In verses 1 and 2, first of all, the arrival of the Magi in Jerusalem. And we see the timing of the arrival given by Matthew here in verse 1. It says, in the days of Herod the king. Herod was an able king from about 40 BC to about 1 BC. Now, there's some debate. As a matter of fact, if you go home and you Google Herod, you're going to find a couple of different dates. We're not exactly sure what his date of death was, really. Matter of fact, some scholars put his date of death at 4 BC. And so then there's this debate about, well, if he died in 4 BC, when exactly was Christ born? And so there's a lot of discussion that goes on. Some recent scholarship, I think, has made it more credible that his death probably was in 1 BC. That's why I put 1 BC in my notes. But nevertheless, what we do know for sure, and this is not debated, is that Matthew says that Herod is the king at the time that the wise men approach Jerusalem. You know the old joke about the firemen, right there, the wise men being firemen because they came from afar. Sorry, I know it's bad, but they came from a region to the east. They came toward Jerusalem. As a matter of fact, many commentators believe that these wise men came from the region of Babylon, and many believe that they are perhaps the descendants of Daniel. And some of those men, those wise men of old, that were serving in the Babylonian kingdom. Remember, Daniel was of great power and position, excuse me, in the Babylonian kingdom. And so, as those behind him were trained up, perhaps Daniel had been very instrumental in telling them about the king that would come, born for the Jews. And they kept studying the skies and studying the stars and looking for those signs in the heavens. So this is when they come. They come during the days of Herod the king. The purpose for their arrival was they come to worship him because they see the star and they travel over to Jerusalem. They know where to find him. When they arrive in Jerusalem, it says in verse 2 that they ask, where is he, the king of the Jews? For we have seen a star in the east and are come to worship him. That's their whole point in coming to worship. The act of worship is the abasement of oneself to exalt the other. And there's been a lot of preaching. There's been a lot of books written recently on this matter of worship and what it is and how it should happen in the church. Right? But I believe you can boil it down very, very easily. When you and I come to worship on Sunday, it's about exalting our God. A lot of people come to church with this kind of a natural assumption that it's for me and for my benefit. And when I say me, I'm speaking in first person, so that when people come through the doors, they think that it's about them and an opportunity for them to be maybe encouraged spiritually, which happens. Right? But the point in coming is to exalt God. That's when we find the most blessing. Interestingly enough, and it's kind of a paradox, that when you come into a church or when you come into a place where a worship of Almighty God is taking place, you would find encouragement. You would find blessing. Because when we together have a common theme or a common purpose in mind, and that is to build our God up and to lift him up in our minds and in our understanding, then we would find blessing. Really? I'm thinking about him. How is it that I'm going to receive blessing? Surely I would come in and I would be introspective and meditative, and somehow I would find some source or means of enlightenment through the course of the hour. No, what happens is that in blessing our God, he in turn blesses us. But it's about worshiping him. So our songs should and do consistently reflect an exalting of God. And as we lift him up, this has come from a heart of humility on our side. The wise men come, and these guys are obviously wealthy. You notice the gifts that they present in the end of verse 11, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Those are not cheap gifts, right? They didn't find those on special to give for Christ, give to Christ for Christmas. They went to some great expense here, and many commentaries would acknowledge that these are probably men of position back home. They have power, they have money, right? And they come to worship this new Jewish king. They want to exalt him, and they're going to do that by expressing their own humility. So they know who they are, and they humble themselves, and by humbling themselves, they see this child elevated. That's their point. They come to Jerusalem to worship this new king. So we have their arrival. Now, verses 3 through 8, we see what happens while they're in Jerusalem. Because they haven't found the child yet. They're still looking for him at this point. And it says that they come in verse 3, and they talk to Herod. When Herod the king had heard these things, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Excuse me. He is troubled. The word troubled has to do with a mental or spiritual agitation. This is what happens in your mind, in your life, when stress takes over. You get really bad news, or things are brewing, right? I don't know how many of you have ever been through a church split, but having been through a couple in my life and having watched now several other churches go through it, anytime things start brewing in the church and you feel like this is coming, it consumes my life. As the pastor, I'm just freaking out, trying to figure out how to fix it and talking to people and praying for people and working. And a lot of times it feels like the more you work, the more things are going south. And before long, it just consumes everything. You don't sleep well. You don't eat well. Relationships aren't right. Trust is breaking down quickly. And you're just always in this state of stress and anticipation. What's going to happen? That's exactly the word that is used, troubled. The king, when he hears this news of this coming Jewish, this new Jewish king, he is like, no, this can't be. So I can imagine King Herod every day, every night, walking the halls of the palace. What am I going to do? What about this new king that's come? I'm the king. I'm the Jewish king. Who's it going to be? And everybody that comes in to ask of Herod, I wonder if he suspects them. Are you the, maybe you're the culprit. I've got a little bit more to share about Herod a little bit later on, but here's a man who is stressed out. So it says then, I should turn my cell phone off. My apologies. So it goes on in verse 4, and when he had gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he demanded of them where Christ should be born. I get this sense from just that phrase that he demanded of them. You know, that they come into the throne room, perhaps Herod gets a hold of them by the collar and says, tell me, where is that? Now, I don't know if it happened exactly like that, but I do believe that Herod, being stressed, and wondering what in the world is going on with his throne, if he doesn't sit them down and demand some answers. Where is this Christ to be born? And you notice they respond in verse 5. And I don't know if it happened exactly the way that I infer here, or if they had to actually go back, do a little research on the matter. But it appears to me that they just knew immediately what the scriptures had said. So it says, they said unto him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written by the prophet, and thou, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, art not the least among the princes of Judah, for out of thee shall come a governor that shall rule my people Israel. Well, the Bible says, Bethlehem. That's where the Messiah is going to be born. And they just knew that. Now, I find it interesting that Herod had to ask them. Why would Herod not have known that? Herod's a Jew, but he somehow doesn't get this information. But when he calls in the chief priests and the scribes, they know immediately. And that's how I would understand it. They don't have to go and research it. Let's see, I think I remember reading in there something about that. No, they knew. They tell him it's in Bethlehem. That's where it says. The prophet has written in Bethlehem, you're not the least among the princes of Judah. Out of thee shall come a governor that shall rule my people. Then Herod, verse 7 says, when he had privately called the wise men, inquired of them diligently what time the star appeared. You get this idea. Here's this nervous man, all stressed out. My throne is obviously in jeopardy. So he calls and he asks the experts, what does the Bible say What do the scriptures say about this coming king? Well, he's going to be born in Bethlehem. Okay, you can go. Now bring the wise men in. Shh. You wise men, how long have you been seeing this star? How long have you known about this? And he asked them these questions. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search diligently for the young child. And when you find him, come back here to Jerusalem and tell me about it so that then I can go and, I mean, give me directions, draw me a map, so mark it, ping it on the GPS, whatever, and let me know where he's at so I can come and I can worship him also. Now, here's a man. We already know that he's stressed. He's troubled and all Jerusalem with him. You just get this sense that there's ulterior motives, right? Something's not right here with Herod. Send me word so that I can come and worship too. It doesn't seem like Herod would want to go and worship. Well, we know that's the case. He does have ulterior motives. As a matter of fact, if you were to carry on, and I would encourage you to this afternoon, and keep reading down through the following verses, we're going to conclude in verse 12. But if you keep reading 13 and 14 and on into the story, you find that Herod goes and he slays the babies. As a matter of fact, the word children is used. So some commentators believe that it was went beyond just the baby boys to probably maybe some girls as well, 2 years old and younger, slain throughout Bethlehem. I mean, this is crazy. And Herod certainly was known for being this way. He demanded of them and made inquiry of them. It doesn't appear that the chief priests and scribes certainly required any time for them to know, and the wise men certainly didn't require any time for them to know and give response. And so he sends them word. Now, Herod is an interesting character too, and I've told you already several things about him. But Herod had two of his sons killed, because they appeared, at least this was Herod's perspective, they appeared to be building alliances that would overthrow his kingdom. So he had them killed. As a matter of fact, Caesar Augustus had a saying for Herod. I would rather be, the Greek phrase is, ton hun tau Herodu, anti ton huion tau Herodu. Literally, I would rather be Herod's pig than Herod's son, because he's Jewish, right? So I'd rather be his pig, because he's not going to kill and eat his pig, but he's killing his boys just to beat the band over here, because he's threatened by his in his position as the king. So he's killing his sons. Now verses 9 through 12, we see then the departure of the Magi from Jerusalem. First of all, a star accompanies their departure. There are a few good theories about the Christmas star, and it's an interesting study in and of itself, the miraculous appearing of this star. As a matter of fact, we saw it already appearing in verses 1 and 2. The wise men come from the east to Jerusalem, saying, where is he that is born, the King of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and are come to worship him. But then this comes back up again in verse 9. When they had heard the king, they departed, and lo, the star, and this would be an understanding of the very same star which they saw in the east, went before them till it came and stood over where the young child was. What is this star? Well, it was proposed by a scientist, or theorized by the scientist Münter, hundreds and hundreds of years ago, that it was the convergence of the planets. And I believe the two planets that converged were Mars and Venus. I'm sorry, Jupiter and Venus. And as they converged together, they made this bright, bright light in the sky. And I'm amazed at the study that people have of the stars. They've really never interested me too much. But since we've moved here, being up on Badger Mountain, we get a good view of the stars here. I mean, they're billions of them out there. I'd forgotten that there were so many stars. It's been so long since I've seen that many stars on a clear night. If you stand out, well, on a clear night now, you will freeze out there. But but on a clear night, if you stand out there and look up at the stars from our place, it is tremendous. So I can understand their fascination. By the way, they didn't have cable, right? They didn't have Netflix, didn't have YouTube, didn't have a lot of the distractions that we have these days. No drive-in theaters. And in the evenings, in that culture, when it was hot, they would go out on the roof, and in the coolness of the night air, they would lay there and they would look up at the sky. They knew the constellations. They had, of course, before long, they started dreaming up stories of the constellations and all kinds of things going on. And these wise men studied those stars, and they knew them well. And when they saw perhaps the convergence of these planets and the brilliance of that, they took note. I don't know how many of you have seen that movie that came out, or the documentary that came out 2007, Star of Bethlehem. But he really does a tremendous job of demonstrating how this all could have gone scientifically. And it's fascinating, right? So it's repopularized this theory that it's the convergence of the planets that the wise men saw that led them to Jerusalem initially, and then from Jerusalem down to Bethlehem. And talking about and going through the details of what is mentioned here in the book of Matthew as it happened in the heavens and the stars as the wise men were watching. Because it says specifically that when they had departed from the king, lo, the star which they had saw in the east went before them till it came and stood over where the young child was. Now this brings me to the second possible theory for the star. Because I've always scratched my head on that one. I am not an astronomer, and I will readily admit, I know Orion's belt and the Big Dipper. That's all I know. When I look up there, I see just a whole bunch of stars. They're all real pretty. Okay, now it's time for bed. And that's about it. Years ago, some friends gave my kids a really, really nice telescope. And I was so fascinated by this thing. We went out, and we weren't looking at stars. We looked at the moon. And you can see the craters in the moon and everything. And it's amazing to look through this telescope at the surface of the moon. When you start looking at stars, I lose interest really fast. They're out there. They're not going anywhere. I don't know. I'm just not interested in the least. So having said that, it was always a fascination when I would watch the Star of Bethlehem and see the science, astronomical science between the converging of the planets, all of that stuff. That's interesting. But how would you triangulate the location of the child from a star that far out there? How would you do that? Now, I couldn't do it. And perhaps sailors can very easily. But it's always made me scratch my head a little bit, to the extent that I kind of tend to think it's probably a miraculous event. This star showing up is not so much the converging of planets as a bright light that God used to lead the wise men from over in Babylon to Jerusalem, and then from Jerusalem south to Bethlehem, and then stand over literally the place where the child was so that they could easily find right on when they were underneath that star. They're standing at the front door of this house in Bethlehem. Maybe this is it. And Mary comes to open the door. And at her feet, there's this little toddler comes walking up. And when they see this little toddler, they know who it is because the star has led them exactly where they need to be. Now, I don't know exactly how all this goes. All I know is what the Bible says here. And when they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceeding great joy. It's almost as if they find comfort in this star. There it is. That's the star. It's been leading us all along, and it is still leading us. So now we know where to go. I don't know how. I've always had a pretty good internal map. I don't get lost in the woods. I don't get lost in the mountains. But I remember the very first time I ever got to college in Iowa because I had no landmarks. Right. There were no mountains for me to triangulate off of and say, oh, yeah, yeah. See, growing up in Colorado in the Eagle Valley there, we always had Castle Peak to the north. If you saw Castle Peak, you knew right where you were, you know, in relation to Castle Peak. Or there was Hartscrabble to the south, the big mountain to the south. There was the New York mountain range to the southeast. Got to Iowa. There's nothing out there. So you know what I started using? There was these three tall radio towers north of town. If I could see those towers, I knew where I was basically in relation to them. Right? But even then, every once in a while, you'd get turned around. I hate that. But I think the star was, for the wise men, one of those things they looked at. Now we're good. And it took them down to Bethlehem. And when they were coming to the house, as they approach and they arrive in Bethlehem, they come to a house, and you'll notice a little bit of divergence here from what you traditionally see in the front yards of the decorations this time of year. Usually, you have the wise men arriving at the stable, but that's not what happened. It specifically says, and Matthew uses wording here that is very specific, so that we would understand that time has gone by. Now they come to a house. Joseph and Mary and the baby Jesus have moved away from the stable. In all likelihood, they didn't stay there very long. Okay. Now they're in a house. Are they renting? Did Joseph build them a house? Because he's a carpenter. Maybe Joseph decided, you know, we're going to be here a while. Mary, I'm going to go down to Lowe's and get some stuff and build us a place. There was no Lowe's in Bethlehem. But you understand, we need a little bit more permanent structure. We need a place for the family. And they come to the house. And they saw the young child. Here's some more terminology that would help us understand the passing of time. Jesus isn't a baby. They don't find an infant. They find a toddler. So once again, it just makes me wonder. As the Magi pull up their camels in the front, get down, and they walk to the front door, and they knock, and Mary opens the door. Maybe Joseph opens the door. Does little Jesus come wandering up at that time? Like typical little guys would, you know? When you open the door, especially this time of year, grandma and grandpa are coming to visit perhaps. And the little guys, year and a half old, if they're walking by that time, come wandering up to see grandma and grandpa. Or who's at the door? Did Jesus come to the front door too, you think? I don't know. But when they saw the child with Mary, his mother, they fell down and worshiped him. This is tremendous, right? This isn't normal behavior with children. Usually, you know, I love babies. I love them. And the older they get, the less I like them. No. I love babies. And when they're very first born, they need to grow into their skin a little bit, you know. But it doesn't take long before those little things are just cute. And they make the greatest little noises. And they've got the greatest little expressions. And I love to hold babies. And I love to walk with little guys. I've got a picture of me walking. We used to live in the parsonage, which was a half a block from the church. And I've got a picture of me walking to church one Sunday morning with Andrea. And she's stretching way up like this, walking on her tiptoes. And she's got her little pigtails out like this, and I'm leaning down, and she's got a hold of my finger. And I remember those days, walking down the sidewalk with her, going to church. I just love that. It has never, ever in my mind, ever entered my mind, when I see a toddler, to worship it. Doesn't happen. But there was something unique about this one. Because he is God the Son, and they understood that. Something about this, they knew that he was worthy of worship. Now, they've just been at the palace in Jerusalem, the capital city, in a structure that is befitting a king. They've left a man who is the king, who has great power. Obviously, he's still ruling under the over coverage of the Roman Empire. But they have just left the Hebrew king, Herod, and they've come to Bethlehem, this little shepherd's town south of Jerusalem, about 5 miles. It's kind of a dusty old place to just another house. And here is the one that they've been looking for. And they worship this little guy. They exalt him by humbling themselves. And I can imagine that these wise men probably knelt down and bowed their heads down to the ground. I don't even know if Jesus can talk at this point. If he's old enough to even understand how to tie his sandal, if he knows what is going on in his humanity here. But that does not matter to the wise men. Whether the child understands it or not, he is worthy of worship. And that's what they do. They worship him. And when they had opened their treasures, they presented unto him. I like, again, the way that Matthew phrases this. They open their treasures. It's like as if there's a presentation, formality here. As they take each of them and they open up and they bring it over and they make a formal presentation to the child. Now, once again, Jesus is a toddler. As they open the gold, for instance, and they present the gold to little Jesus, does he stick his hand down in there and swish it all around and pick the pieces up? And I don't know. Does Jesus, at a year, maybe 2 years old, understand to the extent that he receives the worship and he doesn't play with these gifts, but rather he recognizes their significance? I don't know. Matthew doesn't tell us anymore, just that these wise men know their responsibilities and they do it, even though we would think that's kind of crazy. Jesus is just little at this point, but he's still worthy, and they understand that. And they present these gifts to him, gold and frankincense and myrrh. I'm not going to dwell on the gifts themselves this morning, but I will say this. They are significant in presentation to royalty. Right, these are of great importance and of value. Gold is something that you would find with kings. Right? Usually, they are adorned with gold. Their scepter has gold upon it, if it's not completely gold. Frankincense, a smell. You know, when you would go into a throne room, it didn't stink. This is where the king was located. It smelled nice. So frankincense and myrrh, these they're exotic for us, but of course they would have had some a little bit more access to them in Jerusalem and Bethlehem in that region, being able to find myrrh and frankincense. But these wise men present these gifts like they would to royalty. And then it says in verse 12, being warned of God in a dream that they should not return to Herod, they departed into their own country another way. Typically, you would have gone, if you were traveling to and from Bethlehem to the region of Babylon, which these men were from, you would have gone right through Jerusalem, right along the Fertile Crescent, up in along the rivers so that you could make your way along and have water for the camels or whatever you were traveling, and everything would have been taken care of. But being warned by God in a dream, they did not go back the same way. But you probably remember, you all are a very astute congregation, you remember that Herod told them, go and find the child, and when you have found him, bring me word again that I may come and worship him also. But they don't go back to talk to Herod. They go back to their home another way, by instruction from God. Who's more important to listen to? The king, Herod, or God? Well, that's a no-brainer. And the wise men ditch Herod and go back home another way, so that they don't have to encounter that. As a result, Herod becomes infuriated, right? Like I said, and you can read the rest of the story when you get home, but it's fascinating. This shall not be done to me. And he goes after the little ones in Bethlehem. So what can we carry with us from the story today, from the account? Well, I look at this and I think of a couple of things. First of all, are you looking for hope, purpose, meaning in life? What was going on with the Magi before we find them coming into the story here in Matthew chapter 2? excuse me. These are just very smart, very scholarly, very studious men over here in the Babylonian area. As a matter of fact, we don't even know particularly how many there were. Traditionally, we think there were three because of the three gifts that were presented. We know there was at least two because they are referred to in the plural, but there could have been 10 wise men. Whatever the case, right, we have these wise men that are looking and looking and looking, studying and studying and studying. And when they see the right signs appear, they head off to Jerusalem and they know some things. Have you been looking and looking and looking, but you're not sure what you're looking for? There's bound to be something out there that I need it. I've tried different jobs, and I'm just not finding something that works, that fits. I've had several different marriage partners, and that's just not working. That's not making the difference. I've tried different vehicles, thinking maybe if I got the right rig to drive every day, that'd do it. Well, that's not doing it. I had this goal of getting so much in my bank account. I hit that a couple of years ago, and that's just, something's missing in my life, and I don't know what it is. I keep looking, and I keep looking, and I keep looking. May I offer to you today Jesus Christ, who, like the wise men, when they found him, they worshiped him. They knew what they had found. I believe that they were convinced this little tyke that they saw in the house was God, and they worshiped him accordingly. Today he is worthy your worship. He is worthy. And once you acknowledge who Jesus Christ is for you, then all of a sudden the right job doesn't seem to matter as much. Driving the right vehicle doesn't seem to matter as much. Or any of those things that I mentioned earlier, just by example, right? Because once you find Jesus Christ, and you see him for who he is, your Savior, who died on the cross for you, and you trust him personally, you accept him for your own, that changes everything. It changes your eternity. Are you looking for something today? You just don't know what it is. Just keep looking and looking and looking. Maybe you have found the answer today. Look at Jesus. Second thing that I thought of, how is your worship of Christ? It may be great on any given Sunday when you come to this place. We do the right things. We know the right process because we've done it for years and years and years. But it doesn't necessarily guarantee the right heart. You know, we can come through the doors. We're familiar with the faces that we see. We're going to probably know the songs that we sing. And now we're getting used to the way the new pastor prays and the way he preaches and all of that. And so we can go through a Sunday morning and look very worshipful, but where's our heart? How are you worshiping these days? Okay, maybe not Sunday morning. How about Monday morning? How about Wednesday afternoon? How about Friday evening? What is your worship of Jesus Christ look like? Are we the kind of people who humble ourselves before him so that he can be exalted? And he just stays in that place in our lives. Every day he is high and lifted up. And we want him there. We just keep lifting him up. How is your worship of Christ? Can you learn something from the example of the wise men? I must be feeling a little bit better. I didn't realize that I had gone this late. So the time that I gave you last week, I'm taking this morning. Thank you for your patience. But isn't this so wonderful? I love the story of the wise men and their contribution to the Christmas story. This morning, maybe some things to learn from them. And we're going to sing together in closing. Let me find a good closing hymn quickly.